3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Joe Tate, and I have a podcast. It's called Over the Timeline. I look back at the highlights and a few lowlights of my sports broadcast career. Over the Timeline, brought to you by the Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
And we welcome you into another edition of the Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina. Andy Bulbart's with you today, and as always, we are joined by Joe Tate. Joe, as always, a pleasure to have you on with us as we take a look back in time, and today we are going to focus on some of the early years in Cleveland Cavaliers history as we talk about the very first facility in which they played, the Cleveland Arena. Joe, as I understand it, the Cleveland Arena offered a little bit of everything, some good, some bad, and some ugly. Is that fair to say?
Well, I'm waiting to hear what the good is, because that was a lot of ugly and it was old. And I must admit, though, when I walked in there for the first time and realized that if I was going to go to the NBA, I was going to have to go through this building, it suddenly took on a little more luster than perhaps it deserved.
And what's fascinating about that arena is that, you know, of course, for a while it was a hockey arena. And, you know, going back and looking at the annals of time, all the hoops that Nick Mulledy and company had to jump through in order to kind of make it happen and bring professional basketball to Cleveland, that will certainly stand out as the first home that the Cavaliers had. Doesn't seem like it was the homiest. And, Joe, I think one of the things that stood out to me in reading Terry Pluto's recent book, Vintage Cavs, in which you're quoted many, many times, it seems like when people talk about that Cleveland Arena, it's almost like the dirty old shed in the back, right? It was there. You used it. There were some memories, not many good, but it was a big part of your life. Is it fair to say the Cleveland Arena is kind of along the same lines?
Oh, absolutely, because that was where I did my audition tape that got me the job to begin with. And then, of course, we did 4 years there before they built the Coliseum out in Richfield, and we moved from the depths to the heights, even though the Coliseum out in Richfield was in the middle of a cornfield, it was still light years ahead of what we had been dealing with. In fact, opposing teams used to refer to the old Cleveland Arena as the Black Hole of Calcutta. And they refused to even use the locker rooms unless they absolutely had to. Most of the teams dressed in the hotel across the street where they stayed and then just walked in their uniforms and warm-ups across the street, across Euclid Avenue, to get into the arena. And they didn't have to worry much about bumping into a lot of fans because, let's face it, Bull, there weren't a lot of fans to bump into. In fact, the only thing I ever bumped into was I almost ran over Wilt Chamberlain one night in a snowstorm when he was coming across the street in his purple warm-ups and the snow was blowing and I had a tough time seeing, and all of a sudden there was this large, large persona standing in front of me in the street, and it was Wilt. And you know, Fitch told me I should have just run over him. It would have helped the team.
Well, and what's fascinating, too, about that whole setup, you know, if you think about it in today's day and age, there's no way in the world that that would have flown because there are so many demands and needs and there are so many necessities that every facility must have. It's just hard to fathom that the conditions were so bad that the opposing teams would dress and shower at the hotel across the street. But the more you hear about the Cleveland Arena, you start to learn things about how it wasn't necessarily so homey for the Cavaliers either. You know, Bill Fitch was quoted in the book that was written by Terry Pluto, Vintage Cavs, talking about how he had to constantly get out his pistol just to get rid of some of the rats.
Oh, they went out back. The fellow that ran the Zamboni, Big T, had an arsenal inside the arena, and I think the size of the weapons determined the size of the rats. And he and Fitch used to go out behind the building after the games were over and shoot the rats. That was a post-game activity at the old Cleveland Arena. I know this sounds really weird, and unbelievable to the folks now who go to the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse and see that Taj Mahal that they have put together down there. But that's the way it was when it began. It was an arena bowl that for hockey, I guess, kind of fit the mold of the old American Hockey League. It was a rough tumble. If you ever saw the movie with Paul Newman called Slapshot, that's just about the way it was in the Cleveland arena as far as hockey was concerned. But basketball just fit in there like a sore thumb.
And it's so fascinating to look back at this now, because at the very beginning of the interview, Joe, you mentioned it. You said you're still kind of waiting for the good as far as the good, the bad, and the ugly went. Sounds like there was a lot of ugly surrounding the arena as well. You mentioned it certainly wasn't in the friendliest part of town. And, you know, stories have been told in the past about how there were people that were willing to pay a little bit of extra money to park inside of a gate or a gated lot, because if you didn't park in one of those lots, well, it was kind of a coin flip as to whether or not your car would still be there when you returned.
Yeah, there was more than one automobile that went to a different part of Cleveland in the course of a basketball game at the arena. Yeah, that was also a problem. It was strange. And you look back on it, you can't believe that it was the way it was. But you know what? You read that book by Pluto and you realize why they were permitted to bring an NBA franchise into the league in Cleveland in a facility such as that. It was a battle between the ABA and the NBA, and the NBA did not want Cleveland to end up in the ABA, so they kind of turned an eye when it came to the facility. And it helped Nick Valletti get the franchise that he wanted.
And taking a look at the elements within the facility, too, and we're not just talking about, you know, the conditions at the scorer's table or what you see when you walk in, the conditions of the bathrooms, things of that nature. Joe, it seemed like from a competitive standpoint, there were some serious issues as well with the floor. I mean, we've talked a lot about how it was primarily used as a hockey arena, and as a result, it was cold. There were some wet spots. It sounded like a lot of guys had a really tough time playing basketball at this place.
That is true, but I'll tell you this. I don't want to ever hear anybody from Boston criticize the Cleveland Arena floor, because the old parquet floor up at the Boston Garden was the worst piece of lumber that ever showed up in the NBA. And the Celtics knew how to play that floor like a drum, but they had talent that went up and down that floor. The Cavaliers had guys who were just trying to hang on go up and down there. So it was not quite the same situation in Cleveland that it was in Boston. In fact, Boston, Bull wanted to move the old floor from the old Boston Garden into the new TD Garden that they finally constructed in Boston. And the league stepped in and said, no, you don't. There is no way you're putting that piece of kindling over in the new building. And so they had to go get a new parquet floor. And it really took one of the weapons out of the arsenal for the Boston Celtics.
That's so fascinating, because as we continue to talk about this, you continue to think to yourself, geez, oh man, how in the world did this fly? But it was just a different NBA. You know, we're talking about somewhere in the area of 50 years ago. So it is crazy to fathom, you know, 50 years later, you know, how that all went down. We're going to talk a heck of a lot more about this, the days of the Cleveland Arena, the early years of the Cleveland Cavaliers. We're going to step aside and take a quick break. But when we come back, we've got more on the Cleveland Arena with Joe Tate on our Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
He was a voice heard by Cleveland Cavalier and Cleveland Indians fans for decades.
There's a long drive to left field!
Until illness struck.
I've been at Life Care twice. Both times, they helped me fight my way back home. It wasn't easy, but I came back.
Meet Joe Tate.
Life Care helped get me back on my feet.
Real people, real heroes. Life Care Centers of America.
With locations in Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
Welcome back into the Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina. Andy Bulbarch joined alongside Joe Tate, talking about the Cleveland Arena, the first years of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And Joe, we've talked a lot about the conditions of the Cleveland Arena, the neighborhood surrounding it, and the story as to kind of how the Cavaliers got to the Cleveland Arena, because the ABA certainly fought really hard to try and get in the markets that the NBA was looking for at the same time. And I think if people listen to this today, they immediately think, you know, boy, looking at all these horror stories and listening to all these horror stories about, you know, just how tough it was to exist in that facility. You alluded to it a few moments ago. The NBA, I think, to some degree, kind of turned a blind eye to what was going on because, again, they wanted in Cleveland so badly.
And they brought in not only Cleveland, but they brought in Buffalo, a franchise that did not last all that long in Buffalo, although it was a shame they moved it. They moved it out to San Diego because the owner wanted richer pastures out there. But the Buffalo franchise, it was a little seedy unto itself, but a lot of good people up in Buffalo supported that Buffalo franchise. And then out in Portland, the Trailblazers got off to a good start, and of the three teams, they were the best of the bunch in terms of winning some games. And I know the Cavaliers were able to take 7 out of 12 from Buffalo in the first year, and they lost 10 out of 12 to the Portland Trailblazers, including two games, Bull, that were played after the regular season ended. In order to squeeze in all the games the expansion teams had to play with each other, the Cavaliers and the Portland Trailblazers did indeed play two games after the regular season ended just to complete the schedule. And that in itself kind of tells you what was going on back in those days.
Holy smokes. I mean, it just seems like there are so many different layers to that era. And, you know, looking back on it, Joe, if we're to highlight maybe – two of the finest moments there, and maybe two of the not-so-finest moments. I think fine, not fine, that's for everybody else to decide, but I don't know that you can top Joe Tate's top moment by nearly running over Will Chamberlain. I think that's certainly something that's always going to stand out to me about the era of the Cleveland Arena. But if you were to pick out two of the finest moments at the Cleveland Arena, whether it be on the floor, off the floor, whatever it might be, what are the top two that come to your mind?
One I remember vividly was the night that Dave Sorensen, the late Dave Sorensen from Ohio State, who played for the Cavaliers, and he had John Havlicek as his hero, and Havlicek used to eat him alive when they played one-on-one in games with Boston. But on this particular night, Sorensen hit a jump shot over Havlicek as the Cavaliers beat Boston for the first time in their history. And I thought Dave was going to have a heart attack right on the floor because he was so excited to do it over his hero that he almost lost his mind. I can still vividly see the expression on his face when he hit that jump shot to win the ball game. And, boy, I don't know. There were so many nights that just impaled by comparison. The night that Fitch threw the chair, and preceded the Indiana coach
Bobby Knight
by years in terms of throwing chairs at referees. I know Phil Bova has a great book out that talks about that particular thing. In fact, the title is Throwing Back the Chair. Fitch unloaded one on Bob Raichel. It was a much better toss than Bobby Knight. Bobby sidearmed his. Fitch threw his chair overhand. And, boy, if Raichel had been closer, it would have hit him and probably hurt him badly. I know that Bill still has that chair, which I think at the time cost him something like $5,000 in fines, which tells you how the league has changed. $5,000, you know, you get that for staying out late. And it's a question of money, and it was a $5,000 fine, and Fitch still has that mangled chair in his office down in the Houston area.
Can you walk us through that whole scenario? Because that chair throwing incident is, well, good, bad, ugly. Again, I'm not sure how people look at that, but to me, that would fall into the ugly category. But it's one of those stories that continues to come up when you talk about the Cleveland Arena. Can you walk us through that scenario and lead us up to what prompted Bill Fitch to throw that chair?
Well, Bill Fitch had a persona which included referee baiting, referee antagonizing, anything to try and give his team a little edge. And plus, I think at times he was certainly justified, because there were nights when I think the officials figured, hey, I got a tough one tomorrow night in Boston. I think I'll just kind of cruise this game tonight in Cleveland. So it was one of those things that probably deserved some criticism. But Fitch finally just lost it. You know, the thing about that, Paul Tepley took a great photo of Fitch unloading the chair, and you look at the press row, because we were all sitting on press row at the time. Everyone was sitting there stoically looking at Fitch unloading that chair. There were no expressions of, oh my goodness, or shock, awe, or glee. It was like we were watching him drink a cup of water. And hey, look, he's throwing the chair. that was about it. Nobody really rose to the occasion, except some ball players, and Jimmy Rogers jumped up and grabbed him before he killed somebody.
So it seemed as though you guys knew it was reaching that boiling point. Maybe you didn't know he was going to throw a chair, but it seemed like you guys had an idea that, again, it was reaching that boiling point and he was going to do something.
He came close to it many times. So I guess we just were caught maybe by surprise that he went all the way and unloaded the chair after seeing him come very close to that in the past, when he would go after an official for calls made or unmade as far as the Cavaliers were concerned.
This team, or I should say these series of teams at the Cleveland Arena, it didn't seem like they were short of a cast of characters either. It seemed like they had some colorful personalities and some guys that made headlines for a wide variety of different reasons. Are there any guys that stand out to you that were really colorful characters in the years you guys were at the Cleveland Arena?
You know, it's amazing the people that came through there. I roomed with, to show you how things were going, my roommates that first year were Joe Cook, who played at Indiana. Joe was a great guy. Larry Mikan, George Mikan's son, was a roommate of mine. And then Gary Freeman, who was picked up from the Milwaukee Bucks during the course of the season, spent some time in the same room with me before I was elevated to a room of my own. That was always exciting when I discovered I didn't have to share with somebody else. You're really going to test my memory, because I never thought I would forget the name of this guy. But he was the 6'10 from Midwestern University of Texas, which I have always said was a misnomer in the first place. There are no Midwestern anything in Texas. He could barely walk and chew gum at the same time, but he was big, so he made the ball club. And one night in Buffalo, he was finally given an opportunity to start after begging Fitch for games to get a chance to play. But Fitch had seen him in practice, so he knew he couldn't play. But injuries were such that he finally had to insert him into the starting lineup. And when they gathered around Fitch for the pregame instructions, he suddenly discovered this guy wasn't there. And he sent Ron Culp, the trainer, to look for him, because they thought maybe he had been left in the locker room. He had a tendency to sit in a stall when the team came out to warm up, and then he'd get locked into the locker room, and they wouldn't find him sometimes till halftime if the trainer didn't go back and unlock the room. But and it didn't make any difference most of the time. But this particular night it did. So Culpy set sail for the locker room to let him out. And as he rounded the corner of the stands, back under the stands, there was a concessions area. And there, in his Cavalier uniform, with a beer in one hand and a hot dog in the other, was our starting center. And
wow.
When Culp came back and told him where he found him, I think Fitch wanted to put him on waivers right there, but he sat him down, and after the game, he put him on waivers. And the next day, he brought a young lady who had been spending the day at the Wine and Roses downstairs. And some of the old-timers may remember the Wine and Roses. It was a place, well, as I always said, it's the place where the ladies of the evening go during the day. And he selected this one young lady to come up with him and pose as his wife so he could get travel money for him and for her. He was going to split the money with her 50-50, and she figured that was going to be the easiest money she was going to make all day. So she went upstairs with him. Fitch came out of his office and found that he was trying to pull this stunt. He actually grabbed, and I cannot think of the man's name. It's driving me crazy because I can't. He was legend with the Cavaliers, but that's what happens to an 82-year-old mind. And he grabbed the guy by the back of the neck and the seat of the pants, and he threw him down the stairs. The Cavaliers' offices were on the second floor there in that building, and he just shoved him down the stairs, and he went down the stairs, head over heels, out onto the street, and we did not see him again. However, he went down the street to a funeral home that was there at the time, went in, told the people in the funeral home that he had just been involved in an automobile accident in which his wife had been killed, and he wanted to make funeral arrangements. And so they gave him a room, and he sat down to the phone, and he called every other team in the NBA looking for a tryout before they finally pulled the plug on him. So, and the fellow who whose name I cannot remember, and I am pounding my head on the desk here trying to remember it. He ended up being shot in the back down in Memphis, Tennessee for a $237 gambling debt. And, hey, that's the story, and I'm sticking to it.
Wow. Well, it's going to be awfully difficult to top that, my friend, so we'll close out this episode on that. Of all the wild stories you hear about the Cleveland Arena era and all the characters that came along with it, I think that one most definitely takes the cake. I didn't think that anything would top you nearly hitting Wilt Chamberlain, but that might take the cake right there. Joe, as always, my friend, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll do this again next week.
All right, Bull. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Again, that's Joe Tate joining us on the Over the Timeline podcast brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina. For Joe Tate, this is Andy Bulbarge saying thank you again for tuning in, and we'll talk to all of you again next week.